The views and opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of Natural Bridges Media or KSQD's staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
KSQD thanks Sustainable Systems Research Foundation for supporting Sustainability Now. SSRF provides education, research, and advocacy for regional environmental quality and sustainability-related problems and solutions. For information, visit SustainableSystemsFoundation.org, and thank you, SSRF, for supporting community radio, KSQD 90.7 FM.
Good evening, K-Squid listeners. It's every other Sunday again, and this is Ronnie Lipschitz. You're tuned into Sustainability Now, a bi-weekly K-Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. My guest today is Dr. Michelle Merrill, an anthropology, evolutionary science, and sustainability educator who has taught at Cabrillo College and Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. Merrill's teaching and counseling experience led her to conclude that there is an unmet need for an egalitarian spiritual movement with scientific sensibilities. In 2017, Merrill founded Nova Sutras as a way to respond to the need for a spiritual community centered on the biggest challenge humanity currently faces. How do we help people through the transition from an industrial growth society to an environmentally sustainable, socially just, and spiritually fulfilling human presence on the planet? Well, Michelle, welcome to Sustainability Now.
Thank you so much, Ronnie. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and I'm particularly interested and excited today because of some of the philosophical issues that we've discussed in the past that I hope come up today on the program. So to get started, why don't you tell us something about Nova Sutras, what it is, what its mission is and goals are, and why you started it?
Great, yeah. So Nova Sutras is kind of an open community in the sense of having opportunities for people to connect from all around the world, in addition to encouraging people to connect locally. And we're open to various expressions of spirituality, but always with this core of a deep respect and love for nature. So coming together around that basic principle of taking care of one another, taking care of the living world, we invite curiosity and exploration, but we also try to provide a context of really loving support where we have deeply honest and careful and supportive conversations, mm-hmm. where we have rituals and practices that we do together, where we support one another in exploring new practices that might be helpful to us as we face the incredible challenges of our world today. In this last year, you know, just like everyone else, so much of Nova Sutras has become this online space. But we are finding ways to make really deep connections, even in online spaces, whether it's just providing guided meditation or open conversation opportunities, or providing a little more sort of structured rituals or informational talks and forums. So all of those are still available to us and are things that we can offer to help people. And you asked a little bit about, you know, why do this? Why was this the thing that I was called to do? And a big part of that is having been active in climate movements and other, mostly environmental, some social justice movements and actions, one of the things you notice is how hard the work is on the people who are doing it. So many people get into states of despair, depression, or just utter burnout. And there's lots of research out there in the world that shows that spiritual community, that shows that practices like mindfulness meditation or this practice called Shinrin Yoku or forest immersion, forest bathing, that these are incredibly helpful in supporting bodily health, but also emotional and psychological resilience that we really need in order to get this crucial work done in the world.
Well, one of the questions that came up for me is what appears to be a kind of a contradiction between, well, in the phrase of an unmet need for an egalitarian spiritual movement with scientific sensibilities. So mm-hmm. there's a lot to unpack in that phrase, right? And most people, well, I won't say most people, I distinguish between spirituality and scientific rationality. And mm-hmm. you suggested that, and I'm wondering if maybe you could explain, you know, your thinking about that and unpack it.
Yeah. So I come from a science background. My PhD was in biological anthropology, which is evolutionary biology science. And I recognize that there's this as an anthropologist, we notice that humans universally develop spiritual practices and beliefs, that they do this in community, and that it becomes an important feature of pretty much every culture we have ever encountered. And something that seems to be happening over the last couple of hundred years, not only is there increasing secularization, but again and again we find the largest response that people have to what is your religion or spiritual belief system is, well, I'm spiritual but not religious. That's the one that's growing the fastest. And so, I think part of that is coming from this space where spirituality and science have been set up in opposition. So people find it really hard to, say, be a member of a religion where their scientific sensibilities are ignored or even sometimes rejected.
Okay. We did have mm-hmm. this discussion about the kind of role of spiritual belief in people's lives.
Yeah.
And the notion, as I put it, that people seek some kind, not only some kind of purpose, but also a certain kind of, I don't know, social and cosmic order, right? To explain why we are here.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the question, I guess, is can you reconcile that with this sort of scientific evidence that comes from at least some cosmologists and some philosophers that it's all, you know, more or less random? Well, I think of Stephen Jay Gould, whose reputation is not, I think, as bright as it once was, but he wrote that book, Wonderful Life, you know, in which he argued that the reason that the world is as it is, the biological world, is purely accidental.
Mm-hmm.
Right, which of course is not encouraging, right? Because if it's accidental, then why are we here? So I'm sort of, that's the question that I have, you know, that reconciliation.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's a great question, and I can't profess to have a great answer for it.
Well, no.
But what I can reflect on, though, is this, you know, I'm again, as an evolutionary biologist, there is this very important element of random in how life has evolved. I don't disagree with that. And yet, people experience the beauty and wonder and connection with the world.
Right.
And that can be its own purpose.
Okay.
So part of, for me, what I find really powerful and potentially still quite compatible, even with an evolutionary understanding of everything's contingent and random and didn't have to come out precisely this way, is recognizing that everything around us is the expression of the agency of billions of years of ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
And we've happened to arrive at this point, but that agency is still present, and evolution is still happening everywhere we look. New creativity is expressing itself through life. That's amazing.
Yeah, and I want you to know I'm not trying to diss or put down the whole notion of spirituality. I'm just trying to, you know, think about these kinds of contradictions. Well, how did you get into this?
Of course.
Into this business? You know, what's your background and your training and you know, where did this impulse come from?
Well, that is so I started out as an anthropologist and was really curious about the diversity of human cultures and why we evolved to be these complex cultural beings and how we evolved really to learn from one another. As I moved into graduate school, my dissertation work was about the evolution of the capacity for culture. And I was learning about this by looking at our closest relatives, particularly the great apes. I went and studied bonobos in Zaire when it was still Zaire and had to leave as the civil war started that it a few months thereafter became Congo. And, you know, that was an incredible learning experience for many reasons.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Particularly being there right at that time and seeing what was happening as that society unraveled. Unraveled isn't even fair because it wasn't very raveled for the decades under Mobutu's rule either. And so mm-hmm. just seeing the levels of inequality and suffering and confusion that led to that civil war. And also seeing what it meant for the forest and the people living in them, and the other animals, the other beings living in those rainforests.
Mm-hmm.
Then I had to get out, had to, you know, change my mode of what I was researching. Went to Sumatra to study orangutans, and there what I encountered was, you know, being in what was supposed to be protected forest, and yet there was illegal logging, deforestation going on all around me.
Mm-hmm.
And even to the point of we were essentially chased out of our research camp by loggers.
Mm.
encountering all that suffering and destruction, and also coming from this place of a profound respect for humans and our capacity for learning and for taking care of one another, this is a really hard thing to reconcile, to grapple with. And I came in and taught at Cabrillo, and also had the great privilege to be the faculty advisor for a club that was called the Sustainability Council. And in that, I saw young people trying to come to terms with coming of age in a planet that was clearly starting to unravel. Even 10 years ago, seeing all of the evidence for dramatic climate change and the things that have happened in the last 3 years are just so shocking. Seeing how hard that was for people to work with really motivated me to try and find something that could be of service to help people through this.
Okay, well, let's take a break. And then we'll come back and continue this particular line of thought, okay? You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and ksquid.org, streaming live on the internet. You're listening to Sustainability Now. This is Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Dr. Michelle Merrill, who is trained in anthropology, evolutionary biology, and sustainability. And she has founded an organization based in Santa Cruz called Nova Sutras, which is intended to provide a spiritual help to provide sort of, you know, spiritual refuge. How's that? Refuge in a world that seems to be coming apart, and especially... it sounds like, especially for people who are in science, but I imagine you have other kinds of members who belongs to the, or who participates in Nova Sutras. Not names, but backgrounds. You know, I'm not asking you to name names.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there are a few who probably wouldn't mind, but I'll stay away from that for now.
Yeah. Sure.
So yeah, we do. We are blessed with a preponderance of PhDs and similar highly educated or overeducated people. But we also have just a lot of people who are local activists working on hunger and housing security issues. People working on climate issues, some people who are members of established religions and practices, you know, people who are also practicing Buddhists, or people who are in the Quaker meeting, or other, you know, coming from other religious backgrounds. But what unites us is this concern for the well-being of the world. And that is always going to be something that we all share when we come together. It enables us to create these really brave and open spaces to talk about how we're feeling about these things, what we can do about them. So we have people who are bringing a lot of wisdom and experience from different backgrounds, different kinds of education and different kinds of work in the world. Yet we're all recognizing that the challenges that we're facing right now are vast and at a global scale that we need to take very seriously.
So what does the organization, the movement, do, and what kinds of activities do you engage in?
So, you know, again, like so many organizations, a lot of what we've been doing lately is just having lots of Zoom meetings. that's the 2020-2021 reality. We do have a few issues that are central to us that are kind of guiding themes or projects that we're working on. One that's really foregrounded right now is we're having a lot of conversations about the way that eviction and hunger are so amplified for families with children right now. Mm-hmm. As a result of the pandemic, and trying to come to terms with that. And one of my dear friends is deep into analyzing data from the Census Bureau and various other sources of information to really look into the scope and scale of this problem and to make that very clear to people. So that's, we're starting to organize around that, mostly just to help get information out. And I feel like that, in terms of action in the world, that tends to be our niche. Is we're good at gathering information and then helping to spread it. Similarly, what's nearest and dearest to my heart is looking at equatorial rainforests. And so we started a thematic project called Earth's Three Green Hearts, where we're holding informational space and learning from, sort of on-the-ground reports from activists in Congo. We'll have somebody on a call the morning of Friday the 12th that will actually be reporting from Congo on what's going on there. And yet it's not just information. You know, we, at the very least, we give people a moment of silence. We give people a chance to touch into their emotional responses and what their calling is in response to these issues. So we're engaging the heart and the spirit at the same time as we are informing and engaging the mind.
Mm-hmm. You just used the term calling, and you had used it earlier. Which is associated, you know, since I am not a specialist on religions, I can't remember where it shows up, but how do you, can you expand on that term?
Yeah, well, okay. I am not a well-educated theologian. I mean,
I understand that.
I don't really know what the technical term is intended to mean by the people who use it more often professionally. But what I have experienced personally and what I hear from so many of my friends and colleagues and the people in Nova Sutra's conversations is that there comes a point in your life where you feel like you are getting this clear message from somewhere, from something much larger than yourself, that says you have this specific work that you must do in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that happened. I heard that call deafeningly while I was in the rainforest of Sumatra, and just hearing trees falling down around me and not feeling at all certain that I was going to survive the next 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And feeling very afraid, very just having my heart torn open that these orangutans, these beings that I loved, were so unlikely to survive the coming years.
Mm-hmm. There's something there about the, you know, the nature of those experiences, I guess, that must make one, you know, reflect on these kinds of issues. Some of us who live comfortable lives and, you know, never really confront those kinds of moments. Although this past year has been, I suppose, one full of callings. Is there any structure to the movement? And how are decisions made?
It is deliberately very unstructured. In large part, you know, we're modeled on organizations, such as, if organization is even the right term, like I was just hearing a interview with Keith from Food Not Bombs, where it's, mm-hmm. okay, here's a model, and people can play with it. Extinction Rebellion kind of works on a similar idea of here are a few principles, and if what you're doing is about these, then what you're doing can be called Extinction Rebellion. Mm-hmm. 12-step programs, very similar. Here are some processes, here are some guidelines, make it your own. I'm very much into non-hierarchical structures. I mm-hmm. would much rather be in a network of fellows. So my inclination was to try to think of, well, what structures can we put in place that will best enable that to happen?
Yeah.
And a lot of that is about sharing skills and resources, and having as much transparency as is possible. Always emphasizing that as much as possible.
I imagine it's difficult, though, not difficult to operate, but difficult to get into that kind of a mindset where you're not obsessed with hierarchy, right? I mean, most organizations, the classic model of organization is hierarchical. And I know that every so often, you know, a movement sort of springs into public view. And then journalists and others try to find somebody who can tell them, you know, what's the strategy? What's the movement strategy? And there isn't anyone, right? Because it has been using these kinds of decentralized and consensus sort of tactics. But of course, it then becomes very, very frustrating. Because we're used to having a storyline and having a direction, right?
Yeah. And I think that's one of the great possibilities of this time that maybe wasn't as possible in times past, because the communication channels are so open and virtually free or very low cost. It is possible to have a really dispersed network that still maintains a certain integrity, just because that information is so easily shared in a way that until just a couple of decades ago, it was almost necessary for information to be filtered through hierarchical channels. That's not true anymore. So we're in this very creative new space that has been opened up by the progress of communication technology.
You know, still, it's difficult. It's difficult to evaluate, you know, information. I mean, we've just gone through, right, 4 years irrelevance of facts, right? And I mean, that comes back to the notion that science produces facts, and science has to be hierarchical. I don't think because it has to be, but it is. I don't want to beat up on you about this, right?
I think so here's another place where actually that scientific sensibility, mm-hmm. as a practicing scientist, to me, science was about process. And mm-hmm. that process was, when it was working at its best, a process of peers.
Right.
That the information becomes open, everyone has a chance to look at it, criticize it, rethink it, question it, it's not handed down by authority. The authority only shows up when enough people in the community have said, yeah, that makes some sense. Okay. I think you're onto something. Maybe there's a problem over here. Maybe there's a problem over there. And when there are problems, you dig into that and you try to change it. And so the other part of scientific sensibility and what makes it work is that flexibility, that readiness to change when the model no longer matches the data. You know, well, when you notice that there's a dissonance between your hypothesis or your working theory and reality, then you have to figure out how to change that.
Well, yeah. Now we're getting into what is it, epistemology here, right? And and I think before we do that, we should take another break.
<All right>.
Okay. So you're right. Listening. You're listening to Sustainability Now on KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and ksquid.org, streaming live on the internet. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Dr. Michelle Merrill, founder of Nova Sutras, a spiritual movement which also takes into account scientific sensibilities. And we were just getting to start on epistemology I want to make sure, Michelle, that you understand I'm not trying to pull things apart or criticize or attack. I mean, these are things that really interest and puzzle me as well. And I'm asking some of these questions because I think you've thought about them. The model that you just framed, and I know I mentioned this in the questions that I sent you, seems to draw on Thomas Kuhn's structure of scientific revolutions, which some people will be familiar with. But the basic argument is that in a field, scientists offer hypotheses and theories based on empirical evidence, and that becomes the sort of accepted framework until the evidence. Empirical evidence starts to sort of suggest that maybe the theory is wrong. And eventually there's a tipping point and you get this kind of mass movement over to the new theory. And he called that a paradigm shift, I think. That's where the term paradigm change comes from. But there is also a sense of, what that suggests to me is that belief, what you believe is a very important element in science practice. Do you think that's true? Correct? Not true. Correct? Are you there?
Are you not hearing me?
No. There was that long silence, I thought maybe I had lost you, but it was a challenging question.
I'm thinking. You can't hear the little gears in my head turning, huh?
No, but I assume they are. Yeah.
So, yeah, having interacted with these strange and amazing creatures called humans, one of the things that you notice is that it is very hard to make big shifts in your thinking about the world. And science is intended to provide processes, mechanisms for making big shifts in how you think about the world. And this is very different from a lot of what people have experienced in religions. Probably not true for all religions across the great breadth of human diversity and human cultures. But it's something that we see fairly frequently in different longstanding religious traditions, particularly when they're based around text, right?
Right.
That there's a certain almost built-in inflexibility about certain ideas. And one of the things that that I found very problematic as I did my own sort of personal exploration of is there a spiritual tradition or a faith tradition that I can fit into, was bumping up against those inflexibilities and saying, well, but then what do you do if there's a whole lot of evidence that says that's not how it is?
Well, you know, obviously... go on.
Okay. The other thing that came up for me in thinking about this question of paradigm shifts is that right now, in the world, we are bumping up against all of this evidence from the world, all of this empirical evidence that says something about the way that our global social and economic systems are proceeding over the last hundreds of years, certainly the last several decades. Something's not working right. You know, we're getting feedback from all of these different systems, from the climate system, from the collapse of different ecosystems, that says that things are starting to unravel, things are falling apart. We're getting that evidence from the social systems, where we're seeing, you know, massive levels of economic inequality, social injustice and oppression that are pulling people apart. And so the old paradigms in lots of spaces are being challenged right now. And this is where it's time to take all of the great stuff that we have learned about epistemology, about how we understand the creation of what we consider knowledge. We've learned so much over the last few hundred years. How can we apply that to these enormous challenges that we are facing as a species, as a biosphere on this planet?
Mm-hmm. So science, let's just say science and technology have given us all kinds of tools to shape and reshape the natural world, right, and to understand all kinds of physical processes. But in an ethical sense, can science always guide right action? And that seems to me to be a something of, again, a philosophical challenge.
Yeah. Well, you know, the answer based on the evidence so far is, well, clearly not. At least that would be my response based on what I've seen in the world. So the question is, well, then where do we get the clues about what constitutes right action? How do we build moral and ethical positions that are defensible?
Yeah.
And maybe not for everyone, but for me, part of how we do that is by tapping into emotional resonances, mm-hmm. and by recognizing recurring themes that we see in the natural world. Mm-hmm. And particularly amongst humans, but again and again in other species and between species, we see that so much is about being in reciprocal relationship. The way that science has recognized that living systems create conditions where even more life is possible. That's what's known as the Gaia theory.
Right.
And again, theory from the scientific point of view, meaning we've got lots of data from lots of different lines that support this as a tool that we can use to view and understand the world and create more hypotheses and questions that we can test against it.
Sorry, I had a line of another question, and it's escaped me. So science, okay, science can tell us what will happen. Well, we hope science can tell us what will happen if we maintain let's just say a reckless and unwise set of practices, right? Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it's an important guide. It can't, however, tell us what to do, right? That ultimately, it was your notion about the ethical system. And so, you know, what is the basis for the ethical system that will allow us to, I guess it is control science? Although, you know, you answered that question. I mean, that's not, so it's not really a fair one. But, you know, it raises in my mind another issue, which is often not brought up. And that is that most of our social structures, you know, we talked about hierarchy earlier, that they're dominated by, you know, positions of power, that human at least Western institutions, let me put it that way, the ones that are seem to dominate the world are also structured around power, hierarchical power.
Yeah.
And that certainly is not the way that the world is organized, right? The natural world, there are predators and there are prey and there are food webs and all kinds of structures. But power of the human sort, right, the sort of deliberate manipulation of social relations does not, for the most part, enter into that world. So, you know, how do we, you know, again, and I'm not expecting you to have the answer, but how do we get past that? I mean, I think a lot of what happened this last summer with the Black Lives Matter protests really did have to do with that sort of power being exercised, you know, in unethical ways. So it's a kind of a global challenge. Any thoughts about that?
Lots of thoughts about that. Where do you
want
to
go ahead? Well, you know, we'll have to take a break soon, so you could, but sure. Go ahead.
But so one thing that comes up for me in considering that is again this broader anthropological perspective. When we look across the great diversity of human cultures, when we look at the way that people in different places were living before they encountered cultures of empire and colonialism, we find that there are lots of examples of small-scale bands where there were sort of like personal power dynamics, because we're humans and we sometimes, you know, compete and disagree over things, of course, but that there weren't ongoing systematic power discrepancies. That is actually something that does not appear in small foraging bands very often, if ever. And something that, therefore, from an evolutionary perspective, has emerged very recently. Only about less than 5% of the time that humans have been identifiably Homo sapiens, probably. Mm-hmm. So these extreme inequalities are not something that we evolved to cope with very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know some people blame agriculture for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
You know, Jared Diamond said agriculture may be the worst mistake humans ever made. Something along that line.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, there are good bodies of archaeological evidence to support that. in terms of, you can see that in systems where you have storage and ability to constrain access to resources that lead to growing inequality, people suffer. And they suffer in some very clear ways in terms of health, in ways that show up in the archaeological record as these disparities, where the majority of people are not better off under those systems compared to how everyone does when things are more egalitarian. We find that in psychological studies in different populations. Where there's less inequality, even if it's poorer, people tend to be happier. Even if it's, everybody's close to the average, but the average is really low, people tend to be happier. If the average is high, but there's extreme disparity, not only are the people with less power and less access to resources, not surprisingly, very unhappy about the situation, but you also see much more reporting of unhappiness and mental illness, even amongst the top tiers. Probably as a response to having to deal with all this cognitive dissonance. Humans evolved to be, this is part of my research was looking at our relatives and what makes humans special. And some of what makes humans special is this incredible prosociality. We are so dependent on our ability to have good relationships with other humans. It is our defining characteristic.
Right.
And extreme disparities in power relationships put blocks in there. They make it really hard.
I think
that's a lot of what causes so much distress and tension.
You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org, streaming live on the internet. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and I'm speaking with Dr. Michelle Merrill, and we've been talking about environmental spirituality and a whole bunch of related things. It's hard to describe all of those things. But Michelle, you had just mentioned, the idea about what I think of as social relationships being so important in terms of small groups, of course, but I think also in terms of pursuing and achieving things like social justice. But, we live in a society that really seems to value individualism over any sort of notion of the body politic or the commonwealth or something like that. And how, maybe you could say a little bit about how in Nova Sutras you try to address that problem of individualism, if it's a problem, of course.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, this is one of those things where it is certainly hyper-individualism, and that perspective is, in some ways a reflection of really not understanding how humans operate. And it seems to be a root cause of a lot of other behaviors that have led to some very bad things. So part of what we offer in Nova Sutras, and I talked about, they're just these couple of guiding principles. Respect for nature is one of them, but the other is recognition of interdependence. And it's really important in our society in particular to be able to highlight that. Not that we're throwing out independence and personal freedom and choice. Absolutely not. In fact, being very protective of that, while at the same time recognizing that we are profoundly interdependent, that none of us can make it without the support of others, without the support of other humans, without the support, our active participation in our habitats and in the biosphere. You know, humans don't live if there aren't enough photosynthesizers on the planet capturing sunlight and turning it into food and oxygen. That's as basic of biology as you can get to. So reinvigorating our respect for that kind of interdependence. And there are plenty of places we can look all around the world where cultures recognize that interdependence a little better. And I actually love to use this word Ubuntu, which comes from languages of Southern Africa, which is specifically, you know, I only exist because of my relationships. Mm. I am because you are.
Right, yeah.
And just to reawaken our understanding of that, just to reintegrate that as something that we think about as much as possible, has the potential for profound transformations in the way that we show up in the world.
Do you think that that extends then to the world around us, to nature, to species, you know, to the natural world?
Well, again, at some very basic levels, it obviously and undeniably does. When you look at a flowering plant, flowers only evolved because of essentially collaborative relationships with pollinators. Trees can only grow because of the bacteria and fungi and animals producing soil.
Mm-hmm.
So interdependence is what life is really all about at a very fundamental level. And, you know, there's another level where whether or not it's true, since we don't have any evidence to the contrary, it might be useful to think about other species as potential allies. Are the trees out there really trying to help us out, really trying to capture all of this extra carbon we've been putting into the atmosphere for the last couple centuries? Are they trying to make the world better? You know, we're not making their job easier, but they're still trying to help us out. It might be possible. It might be useful at least to entertain that idea as a possibility, and see how it changes our relationship.
Yeah, I think the task before us is to make that, turn that into a mainstream paradigm, if I can use the word, or belief system. Is there anything else you want to tell us about Nova Sutris? Because we're just about out of time.
Oh, sure. Well, just to let people know, of course, you can find us online, novasutras.org. We have multiple online events every week. And since we're here in Santa Cruz and there is an active Santa Cruz chapter that will hopefully reemerge as we start to reemerge from this pandemic, and even probably in just a few weeks when we can at least do some outside gatherings with plenty of social distancing and you know, respect and safety for the more vulnerable among us, we'll be offering lots of things. So you can check out our events page and learn more about those. We have a couple of great events coming up, two on this coming Wednesday, and one on Friday the 12th. So be great to come and learn more about us.
Okay, I'll post that link on the blurbs on the K-Squid website. So thank you very much. Michelle, for being on Sustainability Now. I thought it was a great discussion.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ronnie. These have been really, really engaging questions.
Okay. All right, my guest in 2 weeks will be Amity Sandej, who is the Environmental Literacy Coordinator for the Santa Cruz County Office of Education, where she leads a countywide effort to build environmental literacy in K-12 students. Amity works to increase student access to outdoor learning and to support teachers in using local environmental connections to increase relevance of core instruction across content areas and to create opportunities for civic and environmental action. Well, we'll see exactly what that means in 2 weeks. That's on Sunday, February 21st, 2021, from 5 to 6 p.m., right here on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org, streaming live on the Internet. As a reminder, the shows in this 5 to 6 p.m. Sunday slot are rebroadcast the following Tuesday mornings from 6 to 7 a.m., just before I go in to tend the station for 2 hours. And if you'd like to listen to previous shows, broadcasts of Sustainability Now, you can find them at ksqd.org/sustainabilitynow, as well as Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Pocket Casts, amongst other podcast sites. I want to thank everyone for listening, and I want to thank Emily Donham for today's engineering and all the staff and volunteers who make KSQD your community radio station. So until next other Sunday, Sustainability Now.
You've been listening to Sustainability Now here at KSQD Santa Cruz.